something spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprint, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Evident Footprints. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and today is December the 8th on the East Coast, still December the 7th on the West Coast. We have a very special guest with us tonight. We were a bit unsure if that was going to occur earlier in the week. However, thanks to the devoted prayers of many people out there, and I'm going to name some of those people as a way of saying thank you to Marianne, John in California. Of course, Marianne is in Arkansas. Better mention that. And a host of other people, Michael Anthony, Karen, Bob and Bill, David, Zachariah, Crenshaw, Sheila, Jill, and the General, and everyone with Project Alliance. Would like to thank all the wonderful doctors and nurses, and I'll repeat doctors again, who came forward and saw to it that this outstanding scientist, author, lecturer, teacher, and inventor was taken care of in a supernatural way. I want to thank everyone for their prayers for tonight's guest, Jim Murray. Jim, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Don. And I extend my gratitude to those individuals as well. I don't think we need to go into a whole big detail as to what was wrong with me, but definitely had... go ahead.
I was hoping you would do that. No, I'm just
kidding. You want me to do that?
I'm just kidding. By no means. That's a private issue. The main point here is that when one of us is a wounded soldier, the rest of us need to come to that individual's aid. And everyone did that with faith and gratitude and lots of prayer. And out of respect for you and what you have brought to my show and the knowledge that you have shared with people. So this is everyone's way of saying thank you. That's all that needs to be said.
Well, I appreciate that very much. And as you know, my heart goes out to those individuals, and I appreciate their efforts very much.
Okay. Now, Jim, just for the sake of the audience, I want to give out some phone numbers here because we may take some calls. I know that we have quite a bit to cover. We had been discussing hidden technologies in the past, and there's quite a bit about you and what you have been doing throughout your career that our listening audience is unaware of. So I want to give out the numbers quickly and then just let you go into, you know, who you are and what you do. In particular, you're going to talk about an invention of yours, which really should be out there right now. It would change the whole world. And these numbers to call in to speak with myself and Jim Murray to ask a question or make a comment, toll-free number in the U.S. and Canada is 888-228-4494. The toll-free number worldwide, 877-489-6350. And we have three direct lines, all with the area code 530. Here are the numbers, 776-5154, 776-5185, and 876-9916. And you can also see those numbers if you are on the bbsradio.com website. You can see it right on the index page. Some people call it the homepage. On the right column, go underneath Station 2. You'll see those numbers there for your perusal. You can pick which one looks attractive to you. Okay, Jim, as I mentioned, you are an inventor, and you have invented various devices that deal with power, let's say transformation or power amplification, et cetera. And I'd like you to just take off and share that with us.
Well, Don, in my experience, most of the time, people like to have some idea of a guy's background to get a little bit of a flavor for where these types of talents come from. And so it was my general idea to start off with a little bit of a smattering of some of my childhood exploits and use that to slowly work towards the adult career that more or less evolved from those beginnings, and then ease into the technology. So with your permission, that's the approach that I was going to take.
Well, and, that's fine. I just want to give them that information so they know where we're headed.
Sure, no problem. So I guess the best way to start off is to say that I was actually born and raised in Jersey City, New Jersey, and born into a family of lawyers and politicians, and they were very interesting individuals, and I owe a lot to the heritage that that family offered me. But interestingly enough, my path was completely different from theirs, and from a very, very early age, I was completely attracted to machinery, to electricity, and to pursuits completely diametric to what the rest of the family was engaged in. Some of the very early memories that I have, a fascination for machines, came from exposure to the big steam engines that used to be on the railroads in Jersey when I was growing up back in the early 50s. And I had exposure to a large variety of machines as a very young kid. And I think that that also led my interests in the directions where they have always seemed to prevail. There were a number of ancient powerhouses in the Jersey City area that I had opportunity to explore at a very young age because of the influence of my grandfather. And one of the gifts that I had as a child, which really stimulated my imagination, was a Gilbert Erector set. And I can remember spending literally hundreds and hundreds of hours building all kinds of things at a very early age with that wonderful gift. And also, I started doing experiments with magnetism at a very young age, mostly with dry cell batteries and little coils that I turned into electromagnets and things of that nature. And one of the stimuli that was probably at least partially responsible for these interests was the fact that my father had a huge library in our home in Jersey City, in which he had an incredible variety of books that covered almost every subject imaginable. And I always found myself looking at the scientific information, books on biology, books on physics, books on radio, books on mathematics. And I did this from a very early age. Later on, I went away to boarding school when I was in the sixth grade. And I went to a really wonderful boys' school on Long Island called Quandre Hall. And in Quandre Hall, they had a library that was almost as wonderful as my dad's private library, and I really immersed myself in a lot of reading. And it was there that I found the first really addictive path of my life, and it had to do with particle accelerators. I read a book that described the use of a Van de Graaff generator for the sake of supplying the high voltage gradient necessary to produce particle beams. And this so fascinated me that I became addicted to it in the seventh grade. And from that time on, I began studying everything I could find about particle accelerators. And so by the time I got into high school, which was only 2 years later, I had a very, very unusually broad understanding of a variety of things that probably elude people, at least into the college years. And in keeping with those interests, during the freshman year, I was involved in a speech contest in which I gave a lecture on nuclear fallout and won first prize in the school, city, and state. And I had similar success in my sophomore year by designing and building an electron accelerator, which I entered in the school science fair system, and again won first prize in the school, city, and state. And in my junior year, I affixed an ion source to that accelerator and did a lot of interesting experiments, which constituted the basis for another science fair project involving the disintegration of boron. And again, I won a whole smattering of awards for that in the school, city, and state, and also in New England, in the New England Science Fair competition. In my senior year, I so drastically wanted to build a subcritical nuclear assembly that I was, but I was denied a uranium license because of my age. And to make matters worse, my dad passed away in my senior year. And I had really hoped to go to MIT, but without his financial assistance, I wouldn't be able to do that. And so I opted to put myself through college and got a job in the Jersey City shipyards during the day and started attending college at St. Peter's College at night, which is located in Jersey City. And perhaps this is an interesting trick of fate, because it was in that college in a very restricted book collection that I first came across the work of Nikola Tesla. And I read voraciously on the subject. And even though in those years I was engrossed in building a particle accelerator in my basement to do private research with, I found my interests slowly beginning to change as a result of exposure to Tesla's work. And I marveled at the achievements of this guy and was dying to emulate him. And so I wound up switching my college curriculum from nuclear physics to electrical engineering. And what made matters even more interesting in those years, and that would have been about 1966, I was dating a young girl at that time, a very delightful person, and she was well aware of my scientific interests. And after we had been dating for about 1 year, she gave me a gift of a very unusual book, which also had an enormous effect on me, and it was called They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. And in this book, a lot of really interesting things were discussed, including the possibility that saucers were propelled by an artificial gravitational field. And this also captivated my attention, but there was a mention of a man named in one particular chapter, and I was flabbergasted to discover that this guy lived in my hometown of Jersey City. And he had actually extended an invitation to the readers that anybody that was beguiled by the subject could contact him, and he would be happy to discuss it in private. And so this is exactly what I did. And this guy's name was Dominic Lucchesi, and we became very good friends. And it was through Dominic that I gained exposure to a whole new world of experiences that rapidly taught me that college wasn't the only place where really valuable information could be obtained. As a matter of fact, I met my first mentor as a result of this guy, Dominic Lucchesi. And the story is quite interesting. Lucchesi told me that there had been a guy by the name of Otis T. Carr, who had claimed to have worked with Tesla on anti-gravity devices and free energy devices and things of that sort back in 1926 when he was attending school in New York City. And that in later years, this guy Carr actually founded a corporation in Baltimore, Maryland called OTC Enterprises, in which he actually endeavored to build and market spacecraft for personal use. And that thought completely blew my mind, and I became enamored with the possibility of meeting this man. And I eventually did, but I didn't meet him directly. Instead, I met a man who had been his electronics technician, a guy by the name of Gene Carini. And it was through Carini's teachings and exposure to many thoughts that I really found my mind expanding in directions that I never thought it would, Don.
Yeah, we had talked about that in past shows. Of course, this is all new to many of the listeners tonight. There are, you know, we could go off on some tangents here on Tesla, on Lucchesi, or on Otis Carr. I thought it might be interesting for you to talk about the Otis Carr Tesla connection, at least the myth that's out there, if you wouldn't mind for a moment.
No, I don't mind at all. As a matter of fact, it was that myth that fed so much fuel to my internal fires regarding my desire to meet this guy Carr. The story goes that in the 1920s, and I think it was 1926, but I could be mistaken. Carr was studying, I believe it was commercial art, and I think it was in Brooklyn Polytechnic Institute. And to sustain himself in the New York area, he was working as a package clerk in the Pennsylvania Hotel. And supposedly he was there in the same years, or some of the same years, that Tesla had a suite there. And the story goes, for those listeners who do not know this, Tesla had a mania for feeding pigeons. He had a kind of a love affair going with New York's pigeon population. And at night, he would go out to Bryant Park and scatter bird seed and things like that for his little feathered friends to enjoy. And he did this quite regularly. So it consumed an awful lot of bird seed. And being the package clerk at the Pennsylvania Hotel, Carr eventually found himself in the position of delivering 5-pound bags of bird seed to Tesla's suite. And apparently he eventually met the man and expressed some kind of an interest in what he was doing because of the marvelous museum-like atmosphere of his suite, in which he had books and models and architectural renderings of inventions and all sorts of things of that nature. I guess it would have been a real eye-opener for anybody with a smattering of curiosity. And so Tesla, of course, having lived his life pretty much alone, must have been to some degree enamored with the attention from this young fellow, and supposedly a friendship was struck. And so every time Tesla delivered bird seed for, I'm sorry, Carr delivered bird seed for Tesla's use, apparently their relationship grew a little. And the story goes that ultimately Tesla bequeathed a certain amount of information of a technical nature to Otis Carr. And this was the basis of his technical pursuits in later years, and the information upon which OTC Enterprises was eventually founded. Now, I have not been able to unequivocally prove that this relationship truly existed. However, I was personally involved with several individuals, Carr himself included, that demonstrated the very, very realistic possibility. And the reason, the primary reason that I have a tendency to believe it is because of the fact that there was constant mention made of a blue notebook, which was filled with all sorts of notes, drawings, physical formulae, and sketches and other information, which seemed to be passed along to several people involved in this incredible story. And each of them gleaned some fragment of worthwhile information from this notebook, but none of the individuals involved had a complete understanding of what they were dealing with. And that makes the story all the more interesting. Carini used the information to try and build an electric car in the early to mid-60s. Carr was trying to build a flying saucer with this information in the 50s, and then later again in the 70s, he was trying to build free energy devices to sell to power people's homes. And so then there was another individual eventually became involved in this whole story by the name of Warren Goetz, and he was situated up in northern Michigan. And he was using the information to build a 32-foot flying saucer in a secret hangar on the shores of Lake Huron. So having met all of these people and knowing them in various degrees, I can say with a fair degree of certainty that none of them personally had the scientific or engineering background to achieve any of the things that they were attempting to do. And so it's very tantalizing to believe, since they all had access to this blue notebook, that there was some legitimate information contained between its covers. And I did see the book on several occasions, although I was never allowed to examine it closely. So I hope that gives some insight, Don, into the unusual relationship that may have existed between Tesla and Carr. And by the way, one of the other things that lends some support to all this, in 1926, there was a lot of interesting stuff going on in Tesla's life, and he was under fire from a couple of different directions. And it may very well be that he decided on his own to transmit information to the future by very unorthodox means, simply because of the fact that most of his dreams that he was attempting to do in legitimate ways were being stomped on by powerful individuals. So it's not altogether impossible, Don. It's an interesting concept.
You know, Jim, I'm going to run over something that you and I have discussed before. Again, we have not discussed it on tonight's show, so it applies here. You know, revelation comes at sometimes the most inopportune times. I'm sure you might agree. And you mentioned something that just connected the dots and shined a spotlight on an aspect of what you were talking about. And I want to regress just for a moment. In my research to Tesla, and this was written about in my Observer article, where I talked about how his inventions had been stolen and his fortune had been stolen, and that the central bankers were behind this. And I specifically identified Union Banking Corporation, and I had, I don't want to say theorized, I assumed, and let's say I conjectured that it would probably be found in further research that George H. Scherf Sr., who was his assistant, accountant, secretary, he's described in various ways by various authors and so-called associates or acquaintances of Tesla, as his right-hand man, we'll say. And I know there was a period where Tesla was sort of secluded in his hotel, And I was aware that Carr used to deliver the bird seed to him because of the fact that he never left his hotel. But you mentioned delivering these 5-pound bags, and it dawned on me, and again, yes, he did go to an art school in Brooklyn, and what was interesting is I did find a Scherf patent. Now, this guy was not an inventor, and it was a very sophisticated device, which he renamed it was something like an illuminator, an illuminating device that was really a projection device. It looked like a combination television set and a film projector, all in one invention. And this patent was filed in 1915 and awarded in 1917. And it's quite possible at that time that Perini did in some way know Tesla. Now, that would be possibly verified by whatever, or I should say, not Perini, I misspoke, Otis Carr would have known Tesla at that time. Would depend on what his age was at that time, but it would be very easy for them to have a young man deliver the seed and become acquainted with Tesla to find out what he was doing. And that notebook could have been lifted during that time and given to Scherf.
If it was given to Scherf, though, then I don't know how it would have gotten to Carr's hands, because
Carr would have been the one to have lifted it.
Well, as long as they let him keep it. If they had let him keep it or make a copy of it,
yes.
That's a possibility.
Well, the coincidence between the two, it seems very ambiguous that Carr went to school in Brooklyn, and although Scherf was also working for the Union Sulphur Company in New York, it was kind of strange that he started his own company, the George H. Scherf Company, in Brooklyn. It's very coincidental that he would do that when he was working for Tesla and he was working for the Rockefellers with Union Sulphur. So this little bit that you mentioned, the 5-pound bag of seed, delivering the seed, he was still going to the parks at that time, and it seemed like an unnecessary thing to do. And yet it was being done, and so he was able to befriend Tesla, possibly long before what I had assumed. So I just bring that up. It's kind of a revelation of sorts, worth pursuing, I think.
Well, yeah, there's a couple of other points which I'll make in later presentations concerning this issue, which seem even more astounding. And they came from Carr's own mouth, which is worthy of note. But if I mention them now, I'll be jumping the gun. Suffice it to say that what ultimately happened was that I met Gene Carini as a result of a lead given to me by Dominic Lucchesi. And Carini was living in Connecticut at the time, and I heard that he was trying to raise money to build an electric car that was based on very unusual technological innovations. And so I contacted him with the number that had been given to me by Lucchesi. And we had a very lengthy conversation and a very in-depth and interesting conversation. The net result of which was that he invited me to come to Connecticut to see his facilities. And a friend of mine and I drove to Connecticut. This would have been sometime in 1966. I believe it was November, if memory serves me correctly. It was around Thanksgiving time. And we drove up there, and I was quite flabbergasted to see that this guy had built several electric cars and an electric motorcycle, all based on this invention, which, of course, at that time he was claiming was strictly his own idea. Certain aspects of it may well have been his idea. But later on, I found out that he had access to this same blue notebook that I was mentioning to you, and undoubtedly, by his own later admissions, he was stimulated by whatever he saw in that book. And the invention was very, very interesting. It consisted of a wheel-type structure that had attached to its periphery a plurality of electric motors. Some of them had as many as 8 or 10, and some of the larger units had maybe 6 large motors connected to this rotating device. And then there was a series of chains, belts, gears, or other arrangements attached to each of the motor shafts and to an output assembly, which was situated in the middle of this contraption. And when the thing was energized, what was interesting about it is that the entire assembly, motors and all, would begin to spin at an ungodly rate and transmit power down through this special gearing arrangement to the wheels of the car. And extraordinary as it might sound, he was able to run this car all day long on 2 relatively meek batteries. I mean, it wasn't in those days they didn't have any of these NiCad batteries or anything truly exotic. These were just ordinary lead acid batteries. I believe they were like 12 volts apiece, and they were connected in series to give a total of 24 volts. And this little car, which was like a sports car, was running around on this one charge all day long, which really impressed me. Of course, I didn't know a whole lot about electric cars in those days, but it made enough of an impression that I was flabbergasted and very interested in understanding the principle behind it. And so I went back to visit Gene on a number of occasions, and we became quite close. And it was in one of those exchanges that he mentioned to me that he had actually been the electronics technician for Otis Carr. And, of course, once I heard that, then I was really hooked. And I told him that I had heard about Carr from the same guy who introduced me to him. And he dragged out all of his Otis Carr memorabilia and exposed me to an enormous variety of ideas, which I had never had any inkling of before Perini's teaching. And ultimately, he wound up hiring me as director of research and development for his company when I was 19 years old. And I really am grateful even to this day that he had that much faith in me. Even though the company itself wasn't a success, the experiences that I gained working in that capacity and the responsibilities that I shouldered were pretty considerable, and they had an enormous effect on the rest of my life, Don.
Yeah, that's heavy.
Yeah, it was a very interesting time.
Yeah, you've got my wheels turning here, and I don't, not to use a pun, it's something that I think I'm going to dive into some more than I have. It seems that Lucchesi's name and Carini's name have somewhat been suppressed through all this, haven't they? Tesla's obviously, you know, achieved well-deserved acclaim for his accomplishments, and the Carini name is known amongst the Tesla fans. Lucchesi, I think, is a little bit lesser known.
Well, he was known in the early Saucer books, Lucchesi's name. And there were a few other names like Augie Roberts and some of those early investigators into the saucer field. But I don't think the connection was broadly made between any of those guys and Otis Carr and or Nikola Tesla, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, just thinking about what you said, too, you mentioned Baltimore. It seems like an unlikely place that you would want to conduct research on building a flying saucer unless you had the backing or the foreknowledge of the powers that be that they let you kind of carry on with your work, if you understand my meaning.
Well, I do. And, of course, the interesting thing about it is if, in fact, he had that blessing initially, then he lost it somehow because he was pursued legally and otherwise for the rest of his life. And when I met him, he was already an old man, and he was quite bitter and defeated by the experiences that he had had. And although he told me some interesting things about his relationship with Tesla and some of the experiences he had with the United States government, most of the time he griped about his circumstances and how unfair his life had been and how badly he had been treated by everybody.
Well, so. Tesla, as we have discussed in the past, had a similar demise, actually maybe even more tragic. And the listeners on this show have actually not heard this story other than when I had Eric O'Ryan on at the beginning of this week. We actually discussed the confessions of Otto Skorzeny, where Skorzeny admitted that he and Reinhard Galen were the murderers of Nikola Tesla on January 6th, 1943, which is quite a declaration. Who in their right mind would admit to murdering someone that they did not murder?
Was that a kind of a deathbed confession, Don?
Yes, it was. And I was able to clarify that this week, that this occurred about, let's say, in the 2 months prior, within the 2 months prior to his death. He, over a period of several weeks, he confided many, many details about the Nazis and about Operation Paperclip, identifying those Nazis that came here and were assimilated into the former OSI, which became the CIA, and was really the cover for the old German SS. And he talked about also his knowledge that they were building flying saucers in Germany.
Right, right.
So this knowledge most likely would have come from Tesla more than anyone else. And we know that his inventions were being funneled through the banks. I had mentioned Union Banking Corporation. And they were caught in 1941, and they were, the word is, shut down in 1942, although they got their money back. And the Rothschilds made over $1 trillion on that war. Those inventions of his that went to people like Marconi, for example, eventually came back. They were returned to him. But he didn't live to see that happen. And it's unfortunate because there was a Rockefeller connection. There was a connection to the Bush family and the Walker family, Brown Brothers Harriman, and other banking families, Kuhn and Loeb. They were all involved in this, and this was really the fomentation of two world wars behind this. Tesla was a prolific inventor during that time, and he was kept so busy or led on to believe that his inventions were in litigation or they were before the patent authorities, and he was just waiting approval. Where here, they had sold these inventions, they had taken the money, and they'd used the money to finance the German side, to finance the Nazis. This money was funneled between the New York banks and the bank in Holland, and then it ended up going through the Rothschild banks under the jurisdiction or the management of the Warburg brothers, both Max and, or I should say, Paul and Felix. And they were literally controlling this through Paris, London, Holland, as I had mentioned, and the Hamburg Bank. And then that money was added to Fritz Thiessen's money, and Thiessen took the fall for financing it because they didn't want to allude to the fact that we had traitors here in the United States, or we had been infiltrated, is a better word. You can't be a traitor to anyone but your own country, and these people were illegally snuck into the country with the aid of the INS and the all the overseers, the Commerce Department and the other parts of the bureaucracy. And they flat out wrote and published documentation that their intention was to bribe the officials. So there's overwhelming evidence that this occurred. And I understand that Otis Carr maybe succumbed from overuse of alcohol, which is quite different.
I don't know. I never could get that 100% straight, but he was a terrible drinker. There's no two ways about that. And that played a big part, believe it or not, in this whole story, because it was while he was in a drunken stupor with this blue notebook laying in front of him on his desk right here in Oklahoma, that Carini actually got a chance to peruse the book, which that may never have happened if he hadn't been a drinker. And then years later, when the Carr operation was moved to Apple Valley, California, and Carini and Carr had a falling out together, Carr put an ad in the papers for an electronics guy to replace Carini. And a young radar officer who had just been released from the Army, from service to the Army, applied for the position. And Carr investigated him, which I thought was rather interesting, by the way, because it shows that he was trying to do things in responsible and straightforward manner. And when he contacted the Department of the Army, they informed him that this guy Getz had been released on a Section 8. So he had a few loose marbles as far as the Army was concerned. And when Carr found this out, he rejected the guy as an applicant for the position. But what Carr told me was that a night or two after that, his complex was broken into, and three things were stolen: an 18-inch model of the OTCX-1 spacecraft, a blue notebook, which Carr cherished immensely, and a Utron, an operating Utron power unit, which was one of the elements that powered the ship, or at least was part of the ship's propulsion system. And interestingly enough, years later, all three of those objects showed up in Getz's possession. And it was when I was involved with Getz in the 70s that I got to see the notebook myself. So it's a real interesting chain of events. And someday I'd like to write the whole story of it, because it's really a mind-boggling tale. But
may I interject something into that now?
Sure, go ahead.
You sprung something up from my memory that I reviewed in Otto Skorzeny's description of the Philadelphia experiment, and that he and Galen were instructed to steal the power units that were being used to carry out those experiments. And they, according to him, they weighed something like 50 pounds each, and there were two or three of them in the ship. So they determined they would probably be able to each carry one out. And at the conclusion of the second experiment, where these soldiers are told or described as having been half in the deck of the ship and half out, let's say, he claimed the reality was that their bodies had basically just disintegrated, that the bone marrow had just melted, and they had no bone structure. So they were just I'm sorry for the description, but, in his words, they were just a pool of a matter lying on the deck. And it was during the shock and the confusion and the chaos of that happening that he and Galen were able to retrieve two Utrons. And they took them to Germany, according to him.
Well,
so
the
it's
interesting
fascinating
thing about
that you would. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. The interesting thing about the Utron is that Carini was the first person to give me any insights into the Utron. And according to him, its geometry was the most important aspect of it. When I met Carr many years later, Carr didn't focus so much on the geometry as he tried to impress upon me the importance of the windings and the magnetic aspects of this Utron device. But what's really interesting about the whole thing is, in many years later, when I started reading Tesla's work and was in a position to duplicate some of it, there were some very, very casually mentioned remarks having to do with the unusual voltage gradients associated with conically shaped coils that led me to do some mathematics of my own in an area where I probably would never have bothered to look. And the outcome was very striking, because what I actually started off with was the momentum axis of a right circular cylinder, and I was actually looking for a transformation function that would allow me to see it from a different perspective. And I'm not at liberty to say on the air what that turned out to be, but what was interesting about it was the net result from just doing one calculation in an unorthodox way was the production of a double-ended cone, or in other words, two right circular cones attached to each other base to base. And this, in fact, is the basic geometry of a Utron. And so there again, we seem to have a connection between Tesla and Carr. Another interesting connection, of course, which was exemplified more by Carini than Carr, was that in his energized flywheel that he was using to propel these electric vehicles when I met him, he was always expounding upon the virtues of counter-rotation, meaning the importance of having the motors mounted in such a way that they had 2 degrees of freedom. The stator moving in one direction, the armature moving in the other. And I thought that was rather fascinating because I'd never seen it before. But years later, when I was studying Tesla's patents, I actually came across a patent based solely on counter-rotation and the unusual properties associated with motors and generators that are allowed to counter-rotate. And this gains even more importance when you relate this to the fact that Tesla published a very, very interesting article called The Rotation of the Moon, in which he goes into great detail to explain the importance of relativistic motion in space and how power is apparently a relativistic quantity depending on the position of the observer. So all these things slowly add up to the possibility that some very unusual information was transmitted by Tesla through extremely unorthodox channels and may have actually survived to the present day and may yet do some good, Don.
Yeah, when you mention the conical coils, I think of a vortex right there. Obviously, that principle was in force, I would surmise. Am I incorrect in saying that, or?
No, I think you're probably correct in saying that. And what's interesting about it is, of course, depending on what kind of currents you have flowing, you're going to disturb the surrounding space in some very unusual ways. And, modern science, even in the most unusual areas of investigation, is coming to understand that space is not an empty thing. And the way in which you interact with space is really what determines the reality that we perceive on Earth. So there's probably a great deal of truth in what you're saying. It's just a question of understanding how to do it.
Yeah, well, I would presume that trying to make a ship and its crew invisible and getting it to move from one place to another in a matter of hours, and we're talking quite a distance, something that would probably take days, is using ultra-high frequencies. So his understanding was far beyond the knowledge of the scientific community, I'm sure.
Well, something must have survived, though, to get to the people who designed that particular experiment, because even though it's never been officially published, it's pretty obvious that something happened in Philadelphia, and there's been a million different stories about it, and you know that whenever that kind of thing happens, there's usually some fundamental truth involved. Rumors like that don't just start for no reason.
Yes, Gorzany was pretty specific and mentioned that Einstein was one of the scientists that got involved, and Tesla backed out. And at the point where he backed out, they brought in a whole team of scientists, and they were really incapable of understanding what he had done. So the first attempt was a failure, and the second one, although they had accomplished it, ended up being a sort of a failure in the sense that there was a loss of life. And I don't care if it's one life. If you're running an experiment and someone dies, it's a failure.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I understand.
Well, I think we've covered that. I've interrupted you enough on that aspect, but we're just about out of time, Jim. We're going to have you back next week. I'm guessing it's going to be Wednesday then. So we're looking forward to continuing this discussion. Do you have any parting thoughts?
I don't have any parting thoughts in that sense, but I would like to say that one of my most interesting adventures in this whole pursuit is the things that happened in Michigan and in my involvement with Warren Goetz. And so I would like to make that the subject of focus in the next get-together that we have, Doc.
Sure. It's just so entertaining in a way and so educational and inspirational to know that there's someone like yourself that is really conscious of history and in a very intimate way. So I want to thank you for sharing that with the audience. And I'm sure we're going to get a lot of emails and phone calls about tonight's show. Again, I'm grateful to have you back with us so soon, and I look forward to next week. Thank you for your patience and for being you. To all our listeners out there, you've been listening to Evident Footprints. Our special guest this evening was Jim Murray, and he'll be back with us next Wednesday. So make sure you come back and pay us another visit. In the meantime, peace, love, and light, and we'll see you next Monday. Good night.